Detroit. The Detroit Common Council wants to save the city's youth from the evils of pinball. The council ruled that anyone 15 or under cannot play pinball unless accompanied by a parent or a guardian. In addition, those under 18 cannot play the pinball machines between 6 a.m. and 4 p.m. Huh. This strikes at the very heartland of men's... I don't know what the hell it is. Man, something. Bring it up there, Herod, please. Can't play pinball. I mean... Oh. Hey, Ma, I want to play pinball. I can just see all those mothers gathered in there when the kids hunched over the pinball machine. Now, a lot of you never played this. I must tell you, a lot of clean limb types never played the pinball machine. Do you agree, Herb? You did, right. Can you imagine taking your mother or a qualified guardian in to the candy store to play the pinball? Oh, wowee, man. You know, I think is beginning to happen to our world. I'm really beginning to believe this, and I never thought I would, but I am. I'm beginning to believe that we are now over-governed. I mean, I think every damn thing we want to do in our life, we somehow call upon the authorities to take care of it. That, I mean, the government, you know. And then when it all falls down, then we get mad at the government, you know. I mean, you know, the obvious solution, if you don't want your kid to play pinball, you don't let him play pinball. That's all, you know. Kick him around a little bit. But, the city council has to rule it. No pinball machines. I'm thinking about this, you know, because some of the great performers I've ever seen, some of the really great performers, were pinball players in secret. I mean, let's face it, I don't think Bolus's mother knew that he was considered he was the Roger Maris of pinball players in our neighborhood. He was just, you know, non-career. And when Bolus was hunched over the pinball machine, we had one called Olympics. You know, they had all these great names. It was called Olympics. And it showed all these people jumping and running, guys and pole vaults and all that kind of stuff, you know, and you had bumpers and flippers and all that stuff. And to see Bolus hunched over the Olympics game down at George's bowling alley was to see an artist at work, a man totally at one with his medium, hanging over that machine, and he would move, you know, subtly. He had fantastic moves. I mean, just the slightest muscle movement, you couldn't even see it, would make that ball go down through flippers, and he'd get somebody, you'd hear doing, 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 ding, 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 doing, doing, doing. And you knew that Bolus was beating the hell out of the Olympic game. And there wasn't hardly one of us who could even come up to the basic minimum score on that game to win a free game. Bolus used to knock off free games, you know, with his eyes closed. He just knew by the feel of the machine where the ball was. And I can't imagine him bringing his mother down to George's bowling alley to watch him play Olympics. But this is the age where mothers do these. You know, and another thing, there's a friend of mine who teaches school. He says, my God, he says, you would not believe the mother involvement with school these days. So if a kid gets a B instead of an A, the mother's down there wanting to know why, and then writing a letter to the school board to have him fired. You know, it's your fault. Charlie's a very smart kid. It's your fault. After all, Charlie should have gotten an A. If you had taught him right, he would have gotten an A. Nobody wants to concede that half the kids in the world got cottage cheese between the ears, just like the rest of the population, right? And we all admit that the world is full of Archie Bunkers, but the world is full of Archie Bunker kids, too. Would you please bring that on? Come on, that feels... Let's go. Ra-da-dee, ra-da-dee, ya-da-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-da-da-da-da. Oh, tonight I want to sing about all the dumb kids, the dummies everywhere they are found. The guys that can't add two and two and come up with... Well, the obvious number five. Oh, I want to salute the dumb, dumb, dumbs, wherever they might be. Be to not be. thank you very much. Hello, wait. Got the problems here. There we go. Very good. Very good, yeah. That cleared that all up. You know, on the subject of man chicanery to man, I'm thinking about that pinball thing. And I'm not about to destroy the morals of the kid types that may be listening. However, there are techniques which I learned in my checkered career, techniques that will enable a man or a kid to beat any machine that's ever been made. You know these techniques, don't you? There's an old axiom among scientists, and that is that any machine that man can invent, he can also invent the counter machine. In other words, you think that the computers are beating you. Well, there's a lot of ways to beat computers. And this is an unfortunate fact, and it really works that way. But on the other hand, the thing that sets the mind of man off apart from all other things is its complete grasp of evil. I mean it, that the machines are basically not evil. They're just chunks of metal and plastic and fiberglass and things like that. They only do what they only do what man wills them to do. It's easy enough for you to get angry about, say, nuclear bombs, but a nuclear bomb is just a lot of pipe hooked together, a lot of pieces of metal and stuff like that. It's what you do with it. And that's what makes the difference. And it's the mind of man that is always on the alert for new avenues of evil. Did you read about this religious organization that was recently in the news? Did you hear that story yesterday, the day before? It's in fact still in the news. Well, it was some religious crowd, that's going around passing out pamphlets about money as the root of all evil. And they were really mad about money, and they just recently busted them. It turns out they had a printing plant in their little old sanctorum there, and they were turning out their own $20 bills. And well, there you go, you see. No matter where you turn, you find that man's mind will always look for the loophole in the most totally unexpected places. Like, here's one here, for example. A guy had a three-car garage stolen. He came home one night, his garage was gone. Just gone, that's all. He says, what the hell is this? He drove up his driveway, nothing there. His three-car garage was gone, and nobody noticed it being taken. Now, somebody's covering up. There's Hanky Panky there at the crossroads. And watching these various little straws in the wind make you realize that man is not necessarily the creature that novelists would have you believe he is. Now, one of my very first... the only reason I occasionally refer to mythical or otherwise childhood is that during childhood, or the age of comparative childhood, is the time when we really either learn about our fellow man or we don't. Now, I propose to you that many a kid has grown up to the age of 18 or 19, and because of the sheltered existence he has lived, by the time he's an adult, he is totally innocent as to what mankind is, the nature of man. And for that reason, he will be continually... Either he will alternately be blown by the winds of idealism and romanticism, or shot down by the evil flak, the anti-aircraft fire of realism. He can't figure out what's going on. Now, if at the age of three, you were already well acquainted with the various wiles of the card sharks, the pool players, the heisters, and the grifters of the world, you're not going to be surprised at 18 that guys are out shucking you like a pigeon, right? And I'm really here advocating what they ought to have from the age of about three on. They ought to have courses in kindergarten in chicanery. Instead of reading about gooey little things like Dr. Seuss and the animal and the Grinch that stole Christmas, and Jonathan Livingston Seagull, all that other pap, At about the age of three, the kid should, learn how to palm a card. So he knows that other guys are going to be palming them on him from time to time. And so you should learn, as we're all taught the rules of good, right? From the time we're little kids, you're taught good. You're taught the rules of good. You're taught the ethos of good, the ethics of truth and beauty. You are. I mean, they're on calendar slogans all over the place, you know. But if we were also taught the ethics of evil, we would then know the Alpha and the Omega. And by the time we're 18 and 19, we would not be particularly surprised at Watergate. That doesn't mean we would approve of it, but we would not be continuing. Oh, I'm so disillusioned. Do you realize? You know, oh, come on. Now, one of my very first... speaking of evil, do you have the money button there ready?
The single most exciting basketball player in America.
Yeah.
Julius Erving is now a New York Net.
Whoa.
Dr. J with more moves than Bobby Fischer. Everything you've ever heard about him is true. And you'll be able to see Julius Erving performing his magic act with a basketball in the Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum for the New York Nets. But make sure you get your season tickets now. Call 516-294-6400.
Hey, you know, that's a whole new way of selling sports. It's nothing to do with the team, you know. Can you imagine what would have happened had this technique of selling sports, you know, the whole new big star comes on the scene. He's fantastic, unbelievable, he's magic. Can you imagine how it would have been have they discovered this, say, about, 100 years ago when the big guys were playing? Give me a little echo chamber.
Yes. The Babe Bambino is now a New York Yankee. Everything you've heard about Babe Ruth, everything you've heard about the Bambino is true. He eats like a monster. He swings a big bat. He strides big and heavy up to the plate. Come and watch the magic, the fantastic magic of Babe Ruth at the New York Yankee Stadium next weekend. The Babe is now a Yankee.
That would have gone over pretty well with his teammates, you know, one of the guys. Can you imagine how it would feel to be playing in the chorus line back of, what's his name, Doc Erving? Is that his name? Have you noticed everybody today is named Erving? Sam, Clifford. This is WOR, New York, your Erving station in New York. And let's see, one of the most dramatic changes in the field of independent school education is that, this is a commercial, friends, is the desire of today's student to retain his family and community identity while preparing for college. Is this true? This change has prompted the Cheshire Academy of Cheshire, Connecticut, to introduce a 5-day boarding plan starting September 17th. And the Cheshire Academy has an outstanding record of placing college candidates in colleges throughout the U.S., after 179 years, the average class size is still only 13 students. It's an unlucky number. There are now some openings in most grades. To solve any transportation problems, the Academy will also arrange for weekend bus transportation from selected metropolitan areas. Cheshire offers a college prep course, grades 7 to 12, and postgraduate work. There is a co-ed day school community with local transportation arrangements. It's a great school. For information, write or phone Cheshire Academy, Cheshire, Connecticut, as in the cat, Cheshire, Connecticut. Phone the area code 203-272-5396. I repeat, the area code 203-272-5396. That's kind of a nice one. Do you have another one in there for me, Herb, please? If you...
When you ask tough questions, you better have the answers. And we do. Example, the beer you drink. Do you really like its flavor, or do you drink it out of habit? Do you know there is one absolutely great-tasting beer? Do you know it's Ballantine? Why don't you try a Ballantine beer tonight? Who do we think we are asking these tough questions? The people with the answer. The only answer. Ballantine.
Yes, brewed by P. Ballantyne. Do they mean that commercial was brewed up by him or what? I guess they mean the beer, right? Brewed by the P. Ballantyne Brewing Company, Cranston, Rhode Island. Ballantyne. No. Yes, well, to return to our original premise that evil is as much a part of man as good, and one must know something about evil. This is a highly educational show we're doing here tonight and is done as part of the vast public service programming here on this station, so that you know a little bit about evil. In fact, we're making available for those of you who would like to take advantage of this educational offer. We're making available a handbook called The Seven Deadly Sins and How to Get More Out of Them. Or Are You Sinning More and Enjoying It Less? We would be delighted in sending you this. Now, this is purely as a public service. It's not to be construed as advocating evil. One must know about it, however, to be able to fight it. And, in fact, recently they picked up a minister up in Montreal. And there was quite a scene there. Did you hear about it? It was up in Montreal. I shouldn't really say they picked him up. They busted into his joint. Yeah, they really busted in about seven cops with clubs and all that, and they found that he had over 16 million feet of porno films. He had about nine projectors. He had 18 bookshelves full of some pretty juicy stuff. He had 12,000 Kodachrome slides from all over the world. And when he was dragged off kicking and screaming to the Bastille, he said, "But I was only studying evil so I would know what the problem was when I gave my sermons." And that was a kind of a shaky defense, but nevertheless, there is some argument that can be made in favor of that. I mean, he was reaching, but nevertheless, can't put a man down for trying. And my feeling here is that, you know, you run into these things early in life. In fact, the first time I really ran into the totally unexpected evil was the time that I was a kid. And like most kids, very few kids have grown up to the age of 14 or 15 that haven't had like 1,900 jobs. You know, little jobs. How many jobs did you have by the time you were 15, Herb? I mean, little jobs, you know, like Mr. Gumpox's lawn, that kind of stuff. Those are jobs, right? You're turning pro very early in your life. You're accepting pay for something. Services rendered to another human being. That is one definition of a job. Yeah. Hey, did you ever get a chance to look at the U.S. U.S. Department of Labor job classification handbook? You know that they have a giant handbook. Yeah, you can get it if you want to write to the U.S. Printing Service, whatever that is, you know, in Washington, and the U.S. Department of Labor has a tremendous book, and it looks like the Manhattan phone book, really. It's a big, thick book, and it has listed in alphabetical order all the actual job classifications that are officially jobs in the U.S. Labor Department's files, which means some wild jobs. For example, one of the ones I had my hands on one of these books one day, and they have jobs you wouldn't believe are really jobs. You know, like flagpole sitter. Yes, if you accept money sitting a flagpole at a county fair someplace, that's your job, and it has a number after it. See, these are like MOS. You know what the MOS is? Well, the MOS is an Army classification. It's your specialized number. So if the Army, it doesn't write after your name, fixes radios. They have a number. It's called the MOS number. So they'll have your name. Say Charles W. Gumpox, PFC, 17989403. This is his serial number. After it'll say 292-794-521-698. And that means all the various things that he's been trained to do, that he does. Now, some of them are pretty exotic, like shoot flamethrowers, throw hand grenades, you know, all these various things. And then there's some very prosaic things, like a drive truck, operate dishwashing machine, number seven. That's a MSG7429/D. He can't work the other models. He's very specialized. That's another MOS, because the other, other number, other machine there. So every one of us has, whoever you might be, no matter what your job is, friend, whatever it is you do, there is a U.S. labor job classification number for your job. Now, you would probably think, oh, come on, what are they talking about? Ridiculous. Not that silly, fat-headed job I've got. Nobody knows if I give a number of that. Yes, there is a number. If you're a flunky, you can find flunky listed under their job classification. It is listed, flunky. It really is. Gopher. Did you ever hear the term gopher? All right, that's a person who only goes for coffee, goes out and gets sandwiches for the guys that are really doing the stuff. There is a job classification called gopher senior, gopher junior, apprentice gopher. There are three different classifications of gopher. It's true. One of my favorite ones that I found in this book was cracker stacker. There is a job classification, cracker stacker. I'm not kidding you. What does he do when he does what it sounds like? Stacks crackers. That's right. That in a cracker factory, apparently, there is, some places don't have a machine that stacks them. They have a guy that stacks them up like that, and they put a package on them. And there he is, cracker stacker. And his number is 6SJ7GTX. And there he, and anytime you, the Department of Labor can look on your file, and they see right there what you do. You stack crackers. You know what that is. And so one of my very earliest jobs taught me some curious evil, which I will relate to you, and I will tell you this is something you should probably not listen to if you're a sensitive type person. Because there are large numbers of people I know who really believe in greeting cards, who believe in Mother's Day and all those nice things. They do. They're not putting down. They just simply believe in them. That, man is essentially a beautiful creature. It's only evil society that wrecks him. Of course, this is in itself kind of a tricky philosophical question. A lot of people tend to separate themselves from society. They believe that they are they. I am Charles J. Bullard. It is society that is destroying me. And, it implies that society is something separate from him. Now, somewhere, undoubtedly, there is somebody who believes that he is being ground down by Charles G. Bullard. Hence, Mr. Bullard is society to somebody else. One is never society to oneself. One is only society to the others. That's a Shepherd's Rule of Thumb number 14D. It's under basic, dull philosophical concepts. You'll find that listed in the Blue Book exam. I hope you've taken notes on that, because that's going to come up. I'm this kid. I'm walking around, and there was this old duffer that lived about two blocks down the street there, and his name was Mr. Scott. I often remember Mr. Scott, because it was through Mr. Scott, inadvertently, he was very innocent, that I learned the true face of evil, or at least one facet of the true face of evil. There's no such thing as the true face of evil. No, indeed. Evil has many faces, by George. But nevertheless, sometimes it doesn't even have a face. It just has claws. it doesn't come around with a face on it. But nevertheless, I'm sitting around as a kid, and as usual, most kids are scratching for dough. This has not changed since the days of Ptolemy. When you're a junior pharaoh, you don't have much dough, really, compared to the big pharaohs. And it's all a matter of perspective. I'm sure that the Rockefellers' kids think that they don't have any heavy dough. Oh yeah, I've seen them. And so it's all a matter of perspective. And I was just scratching around. It was a hot summer day. I was down on my uppers. And in fact, I have to tell you that almost invariably we are drawn into evil through our own basic greed. My greed in that period of time was really centered around model airplanes. Did you ever go through the model airplane thing? I don't think you did, Jerry, did you? Huh? Well, that's, I mean, the real... You either have it, it's like pregnancy. You either are or you ain't. Yeah, you can't just say, well, I built one once. That's not the same way. That when you get into the model airplane thing, really get into it, it is a madness. But even transcends the stamp madness. And it does. And it becomes quite expensive. You start going out, you know, and you start buying these 1/8 balsa longerons. You start buying, you know, and when your average weekly income is maybe 18, 19 cents, it gets pretty rough around the edges. So, naturally, I was casting about looking for a source of additional income. And I found out through another kid that there was such a source. And that what I should do is go down and see Mr. Scott. Because a kid named Stanley Roper had been working for Mr. Scott, and now Stanley Roper was away at summer camp, and quite possibly I could make myself a couple of bucks taking over his job. So I went down to see Mr. Scott. He was an ancient guy who was all totally white. He impressed me as being completely white. He had white hair, white skin. He wore these white shirts all the time. So the old gentleman type, you know, always wears suspenders with white shirts, and he had a tie on all the time in the middle of a heat. And he had a house that was made out of brick. And around the house was this big lawn. And it was a really nice lawn. It was a big lawn, and around the back of the house had a fence. It was a big lawn, great big lawn. It had a couple of trees in the middle of it. And the lawn was terraced. It had a kind of a sloping terrace-like. And so I go up on the porch there, and I knock on the door. Mr. Scott comes out. He says, yes. I said to Mr. Scott, I live down the two blocks down, and I hear that Stanley Roper has been working for you, and he doesn't work anymore for you. Yes. He mowed my lawn twice a week. And I said, well, I'd be delighted to give you his job while he's away at camp. I was wondering who I would get. So I took over the job. Now, I earned $1.50 per day, which was pretty good. Yes, that was unbelievable, in fact, to mow the lawn. Now, what I would do, I would go there on Monday, and I would go there usually on Thursday. So twice a week, I would go out. And the reason he wanted it mowed all the time like that is because he had this great grass, and if you didn't mow it regularly, it would be so tough to mow that it would cause problems. And so I would go there twice a week and mow the lawn. And I would go there about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I would mow the lawn until around 5, and he would bring out lemonade. Yeah, it was kind of nice, see, and I would mow the lawn. Now, he had one of these little things that you use to cut the grass right along the side of the sidewalk. You know, these little things had a little wheel on it, and you want to roll along, see? Well, I would get out that thing, and I would, you know, I was really kind of proud of this lawn, because I really worked on it. And this went for about, maybe a month. And I was really, you know, fitting in on this thing. I took care of the lawn. I was a professional lawn taker care of her. You know, I was a professional horticulturist. And I suppose somewhere in the U.S. Department of Labor job classifications, there was a little note for guys like me. And I was earning a cool $3 a week, which was, you know, kept me in airplane dope. Those were the days when people actually built airplanes out of airplane dope, out of airplane glue. No, I mean, if you sniffed it, you only sniffed it inadvertently. Like one time I was down in the basement, and I had this card table that I was using. I had an old card table which I had resurrected from the junk that I used to build model airplanes on. I'll tell you why a card table is particularly good for building model airplanes. Now, there were desks, there were tables around the house, but this was a card table because the top of the card table was made out of some kind of pressed cardboard material, and you could stick pins into it easily. Now, you follow? Okay. So when you put your plans out, you'd lay your plans out, you'd stick the pins in, you're making the side of the fuselage, you know, and you're pinning the wings down, all that stuff. It was a really great thing to build model airplanes on. Well, the reason I built them down in the basement was because after 4 or 5 giant firestorms we had in the house, and my mother flipping because of paper and pieces of balsa wood and pins and junk all over the floor, she says, you're not going to build these airplanes up here anymore. Either that or you're going to have to clean it up every day. Well, you know, when you're building an airplane, it takes like a month of working on this plane. If you had to clean it up all the time, you know, you'd have to move it and all that. So I did. And it had a low ceiling. You got that. The basement, a low ceiling. It also did not have what you'd call ideal ventilation, the basement, since it was a basement. It had a couple of these little tiny windows, you know, that were at ground level with a little concrete thing around it, you know, and it was also cool down here, see. So on one hot afternoon, I'm down there working away, and I remember what I was doing. What I was doing caused the problem. I had finished this wing. The airplane in question, if you're curious what type of airplane it was a Grumman F3F, which was a fighter-type Navy plane. And I had the kit, beautiful airplane. And I had finished the wing, and the wing was covered with this Japanese rice paper. Now, covering an airplane wing and covering, and in fact, a fuselage of that type, it was an oval fuselage, is an art form in itself. That is one of the most difficult parts of building a model airplane, is covering an airplane properly. Well, I was pretty good at it after building, about 500 bad models. I was finally getting really good at it. And so I had made this beautiful wing, and I decided it was not going to be a flying model. It was going to be a scale model. It would fly if I wanted to, but I wanted it to be a scale model to hang from the ceiling. Beautiful scale model of an F-3F, a Grumman fighter plane, a Navy fighter plane with the fuselage all beautifully covered. And it had retractable landing gear that pulled up into the fuselage, two wheels up against. Yes, that's the F-3F. So also the F-2F was something like it, too. So I built this model, and now I was in the process of covering it. Now, to make the decision whether it's going to be a scale model, which is not is a non-flying model, or a scale flying model, involved basically weight. Some things you did to make it a flying model, you didn't do to make it a scale model, vice versa. Well, one of the things you did to make it a scale model was to spray the wings, now get this, with a very fine solution of aircraft dope. That's what you call sniffing glue today. Aircraft dope, which you mixed with a thinner, and you had a sprayer, and you sprayed your wings with this. Now, that made the wing pretty heavy, but it also made it beautiful and tough, and it made it very tight. It just looked like a real... Yeah, oh, it stretched beautifully, see? So I'm down there with a spray, and it was the kind of spray thing that have you ever seen the type that artists use, that you screw into a bottle and you blow into with your lips, like that? It produces a pressure, and it atomizes stuff. So I'm blowing this stuff away, see? Yes, very fast, because it dries like Billy B. Day. You wouldn't believe anything. It dry as fast as aircraft dope. So I'm blowing. I flip the wing over, and I take the bottom side. Well, I took the wing then and held it up, looking at it through the light. There was a dim light down there, and I could see this stuff is drying fast. As soon as it dried, took about 8 milliseconds, I did it again. I was going to do 4 coats on each wing, and 4 wings. Yeah. 4 halves of wings. About the third one, I couldn't figure out what's happening. I felt the whole room was tilting. I got practically sleepy. I was really sleepy, and I'm blowing this stuff on this wing, and I just was overcome at that point by an incredible lassitude. I mean, really fantastic feeling of like I was melting. I was completely melting, and I just started drifting off, and I'm sitting down there, and I don't remember much of what happened at that point. I'm just sitting there, see, and my kid brother came down. That I do recall. My kid brother came down, and he said something to me, and I heard him running upstairs. The next thing I know, my old man is down there, my mother is down there, and I'm being dragged out of the basement. Apparently, they didn't even know about this airplane stuff. In other words, what I'm saying here is that I made a discovery, which many people have discovered, but I did it empirically, just by experimentation. I was bombed out of my skull, just blowing stuff on that wing of that airplane. So here I was. I was deeply involved in the model airplane mystique. I wanted to buy. I was saving up to buy this beautiful gas model motor that they had down at the hobby shop. I saw it in the window there all the time, and I was reading about it all the time in the model airplane magazines. And I was going to make a big move into this motor. Now, this is essential to the plot. And one day, I talked to Mr. Scott. See, we were sitting out there drinking our lemonade. Mr. Scott says, "What do you do with your money?" And I said, "Well, I do a lot of things. You know, I buy fielder's mitts and all that kind of stuff. And I'm going to buy this model airplane motor, this gas motor." "Oh, it's really interesting. You're building model airplanes?" "Yes, I do." And he said, "That's very nice. How much did it cost?" Well, I named this figure. It was very expensive for me. It was like $18. And it's very interesting. So time went on, and I continued to mow along, and I continued to spend long, dreamy mornings and late evenings down in the basement building Curtis Robbins, building gull wing Stinsons, building beautiful models. I had my whole ceiling of my bedroom covered, hanging models, just hanging in all kinds of great-looking models. And one day, after having mowed the lawn on Thursday, it happened on a Friday. I'm downstairs working on the model, and I hear the phone ring upstairs. And my mother comes to the landing. She says, "Gee." I says, "Yes." "Would you come up here quick?" "What's up, you know?" So I I'm holding a piece of balsa wood that I'm trying to glue. If you ever tried to glue something, you spend most of your time holding it, see? And so it doesn't spring apart. Oh, man. And I said, "Oh, wait a minute, I'm holding something." She said, "You've got to come up there right away." I said, "What am I going to do?" So I took the whole damn fuselage upstairs, still holding it. See, I go upstairs, I'm holding it like that. I'm putting these lingerie on. And she says, "The police are on the phone." I says, "The what?" "The police are on the phone. They want to talk to you." "What the hell?" At which point, I very carefully put my fuselage down. I didn't care whether she flew apart or not. I'm going to answer the phone, so I picked up the phone. And this guy says, are you the kid that mows Mr. Scott's lawn?" I says, "Yes, I am." "You come down to Mr. Scott's house. We're down here now. We'd like to talk to you right away." I said, "Me?" "Yes, you've got to come down right away. This is Sergeant O'Gonigal. Make sure that you're down here in the next 10 minutes. I held up the phone. I get on the street. He's two blocks away, remember. And I get on my bike and I go pedaling down the street. And when I got down there, here were about four squad cars all around Mr. Scott's house with the lights going. And I could not believe what I saw. Unbelievable. Well, I'll just have to tell you basically what it was. I couldn't believe it when I saw it. It was then that I saw the first inkling in my life of the true face of evil. Man's mind is capable of incredible circumlocutions of evil. If you think you've seen it all, friends, you have not even seen one tiny iota, one smidgen, one bitsy-itsy piece of it. There were the squad cars. There was Mr. Scott up on his porch, talking to about seven patrolmen, gigantic cops. And I saw what had happened. Somebody during the night had stolen Mr. Scott's lawn. The entire lawn was gone. There was nothing but dirt. I go over the porch and I say, "What happened?" And Mr. Scott turned to me and says, "That's him. That's him." I said, "What do you mean? That's me. Yeah, that's me." And the cop says, are you the kid that mows Mr. Scott's lawn? Your name's Shepard?
Yeah.
All right, come on inside. We want to talk to you.
I went into the living room of Mr. Scott's house, the first time I've ever been inside, and he had all these little pots of plants growing. There was cats running around. And I sat down on a couch.
And the cop says, you left here last night at what time?
5 o'clock. I think it was about 5:15.
And that was the last time you saw Mr. Scott's lawn until this very minute?
Yeah, it is.
Are you aware that somebody arrived here last night when Mr. Scott was asleep? With trucks and with equipment and removed that entire lawn?
No.
All right, kid, sit down. Are you aware of how much this lawn costs?
It never occurred to me that lawns were worth money.
$12 a square yard for the type of sod that Mr. Scott had on his lawn. I stole $2,000 worth of lawn.
$2,000.
Well, they questioned me for about an hour. And finally, one of the cops says, you stay around town. We may need you for further questioning. And Mr. Scott was plucking at his handkerchief, looking worried. And I said, I didn't do it, Mr. Scott. He says, I know you didn't, son. And I went home. And my mother was sitting on the front porch waiting for me. She was scared. After all, it isn't every day that the kid gets called down to talk to the cops. And apparently there was something in my face. My face was, you know, like the color of old mashed potatoes.
She said, what happened? What happened? What'd you do?
I said, Ma, nothing. I didn't do nothing. The police wanted to talk to me.
She said, what about?
Mr. Scott's lawn.
She said, what about Mr. Scott's lawn?
Somebody stole it.
Somebody stole Mr. Scott's lawn?
I said, yes, Ma.
Will you stop lying to me? Now tell me what they wanted to hear from you. That's what it's about. Somebody stole Mr. Scott's lawn. And they thought maybe I knew something about it.
Well, for about 10 minutes, she didn't believe me. And then she slowly came around. And from that minute on, I realized that I had never turned my back on that basic knowledge. Nothing is safe from the evil ones. If the evildoers want to steal the Great Pyramid at Giza, damn it, they will.